Hello and welcome to Line One, Your Health Connection on Alaska Public Media. I'm Dr. Jay Butler, your host for today. Roughly 1 in 25 Alaskans develop colon cancer, yet we still know little of the causes of this all too common and life-threatening disease. It's estimated that there will be 140,000 new cases of colon cancer and over 50,000 deaths in the United States during 2018. Colon cancer is the third most common cause of cancer found in men after prostate and lung, and also the third most common cause of cancer in women after breast and lung. According to the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, colon cancer is the second most common type of cancer among Alaska Native men and women, and while the overall rates of colon cancer in the U.S. have declined by roughly 25% over the past 40 years, a similar decline has not been seen for Alaska Native people, and the rates of disease are nearly twofold higher for Alaska Native people than for non-natives living in Alaska. My guest today is Dr. Stephen O'Keefe, professor of medicine at the University of Pittsburgh. Dr. O'Keefe has been in Alaska for the past month, but he had to return to Pittsburgh, so he joins us today from the studios of NPR affiliate WQED in Pittsburgh. And today we're discussing the interaction of the diet, the microbiome, and the risk of colon cancer. Dr. O'Keefe, welcome to Line One, Your Health Connection.
Good morning.
And thank you for recognizing the time difference, because I know it's good afternoon for you.
Hard to think about that one.
So in a couple of programs over the past couple of months, we've used the term microbiome, which is not something we spend a lot of time defining. For example, in a conversation with Dr. Lily Liu, one of the neonatologists here in Anchorage, we talked about the role of the microbiome and the risk of necrotizing enterocolitis in preterm infants. It's a word that, I don't know, it conjures images of little versions of the terrariums we used to make when I was a kid, but we've not really spent a lot of time talking about it. So let's start with some very basic background information. What is the microbiome?
So the microbiome has always been with us right through evolution, and it is part of the environment. And until very recently, we haven't understood the enormous magnitude of the different type of the constituents of the microbiome, because we didn't have the tools to identify the different types of microbiota living on our body. So the microbiome is a collection of single-cell organisms, mainly bacteria, but also archaea and viruses and fungi. And they live generally in harmony with the rest of the world. They start off, the soil has a very large microbiome. Every plant that we eat has its own microbiome. And as we sort of understand more from the human side, we're focusing on the microbiome of the humans, which, and particularly the microbiome that live within us in our gastrointestinal tracts. So it's a continuum. So there's an exchange, free exchange of microbes from the environment that go through our bodies and then exit. They're replaced by others. But it happens that we've evolved through millions of years to develop gastrointestinal tracts, which harbor a very large number of microbiomes in our colons. Because food, when we eat it, goes through fairly rapidly through the small intestine, where it's mainly digested. And the residues then end up in the colon. And the microbes find a safe harbor because things don't move through very fast, and so they've got a lot of time to digest residues from the diet, particularly residues from carbohydrates and proteins, and that provides their food source. In return, they provide essential nutrients to the colon, which maintain its health, and also a number of nutrients that are distributed around the body, which maintain general body health, which we can talk about later. Size-wise, it's dramatic because the number of microbes within our gut equal the number of cells in our own body, and their genetic capacity exceeds our genetic capacity by about 300-fold. So you can understand that this is not just a stagnant mass of things living in our colons. It's a vibrant mass which is likely to have major impact upon the health of our colon and our bodies.
I'm feeling a little outnumbered at the moment.
Right. Well, we've been called superorganisms because, you know, as you can imagine, we're compound. We have our own cells, and then we have the microbiota. So it's an extremely complex thing, and therefore we have to rely on systems biology to understand the importance of why there is so much diversity within the microbiome, why there's so many different types of bacteria, viruses, fungi living within us.
It strikes me this is a major change in the way we have thought of microbes within the body. I know when I did my medical training, we oftentimes talked about the microbial flora as if the body is a flower bed and we're blooming, and I'm sure that floral image of our lower colons may be somewhat attractive, but is really not very accurate. And perhaps a better analogy is that we're more like a coral reef where there's an interaction between our own cells that make up our body and the cells within, and that if that coral reef is out of harmony, to use the term you used earlier, the reef itself can be threatened structurally.
Absolutely. I mean, there's, as you probably know, the coral reefs are one of the major microbiome systems in our world. And a lot of reef destruction that's occurring now has been a consequence of subtle changes in the microbial content of the various different types of coral.
I know our mutual friend, Dr. Marty Blaser, has written that the sum weight of all the microbes in our body is about 3 pounds, which is about the same as the weight of a human brain. So that highlights just how much of our biomass is made up of microbes. Now, you used the term microbiomes, which was interesting because sometimes people talk about the microbiome as if it is in and of itself a organ or is a uniform system within the body. But it sounds like that's not necessarily the case, that the microbiome of, say, the small bowel may be different than the microbiome of the lower bowel, which may be different than the microbiome of the skin. Is that correct?
Absolutely. So it depends upon the conditions where they're harbored. So in the small intestine, large numbers are prevented by the secretions of the stomach and the pancreas. So gastric acid suppresses bacterial growth, and pancreatic enzymes and bile also suppress growth. You don't get many microbes surviving in the upper gastrointestinal tract, but as you motor down the tract, all the acid is absorbed and the pH becomes neutral. And by the time you get to the colon, things become ideal because, as I say, the transit is slow. So most of our food gets down to the colon in a couple of hours after eating, and then it sits around in the colon for over a day, depending upon what you eat and where you come from. So you can see there's a big change in conditions in the colon that makes it ideal for high populations. And the bacterial population is one of the densest in the world, and it can go up to 10 to the 12th, 10 to the 15th. So we're talking about massive numbers. On the skin, there's less of a sort of a safe environment for them. So, you know, they don't last quite as well or can't populate as well. There's always a microbiome there. And in different parts of the world, of the body, such as the mouth, again, you know, there's a lot of movement through there. And other orifices, such as the vagina, also has its own microbiome. The conditions are different, the pH is different, so the types of microbes that you give, you get flourishing in those different areas of the body vary.
Okay. So, yeah, the ecology will drive what inhabits the area, and you have areas that are more densely populated, maybe like the Brooks Range may have more caribou than people, but Anchorage has a high population and a dense population of human beings. And I hope listeners in Anchorage will forgive any unintended comparisons between Anchorage and the colon. So you're listening to Line One, Your Health Connection on Alaska Public Media, and we'd welcome you to join the conversation. This is Dr. Jay Butler. I'm talking today with Dr. Stephen O'Keefe, and our subject is the diet, the microbiome, and the risk of colon cancer. You can call in at 888-353-5752. That's a statewide toll-free number. Or you can contact us by email at lineone@alaskapublic.org. So, Dr. O'Keefe, let's move into some of your observations on the relationship between diet and the microbiome of the colon. You had worked as a gastroenterologist in Africa and in the U.S., and I understand you had noted how common colon cancer is among African Americans, but how unusual it was among persons living in Africa. Tell us more about how you explored the possible causes of this difference.
Yes, it was amazing because practicing as a gastroenterologist in Africa, one did colonoscopies and very, very rarely found colonic polyps, which are the precursors for colon cancer. Whereas when I came back to the USA, practicing first in Richmond, Virginia, and then in Pittsburgh, nearly every second African-American that I endoscoped, I would find evidence of colonic polyps, which are connected with colon cancer risk. And this was borne out by the studies of the incidence rates, relative incidence rates of colon cancer between different populations around the world. So in Africa, in rural Africa, colon cancer is remarkably rare, less than 5 per 100,000. And this was noted by Burkitt, working before the days of the microbiota, after the last war in Central East Africa, who noted that colon cancer was extremely rare. And he linked it to the effects of the traditional African diet, which was high in fiber.
I remember that from medical school, actually. So that's that goes back a number of decades.
Absolutely. So he was a remarkable man. He was an Irishman who went over there and practiced as a surgeon and just went around with a notepaper and pencil and made notes about what he saw. And as you know, he became famous initially because linking up
Burkitt's lymphoma
with EB virus by mapping out, you know, it's the regionality of the disease that had to be associated with an infectious agent. And he then did the same thing with diet, and he noticed this that you know, non-infectious colonic diseases were extremely rare, and you know, the diet was very high in fiber. And he, at the time, he thought, well, fiber worked because it actually moves things along, so therefore things don't dwell in the colon for long enough to become, to produce carcinogenesis. So that background was very interesting. And in the incidence rates in African Americans were the highest in the lower 48, at about 50 per 100,000. So it's from less than 5 to over 50 per 100,000, massive differences. And so, you know, there had been a number of studies, epidemiological studies from around the world, tracing dietary intake with what the incidence rates were for colon cancer. They identified certain dietary items that were associated with high risk and others that were associated with low risk. And the pattern is a westernized diet, which we know well, hamburgers, fries, and all those good things, compared to the African diet, which was mainly plant-based and high in fiber. So the African diet was low in meat, high in fiber, low in fat. African-American was high in fat, high in protein and meat, preserved meats, and very low in fiber. And to further investigate this, we managed to get a little grant from the AICR, American Institute of Cancer Research, to go out and measure dietary intakes in both communities and confirm that, you know, the African diet was associated with high fiber, low meat intake, whereas the African American was the reverse. And about this time, the microbiome suddenly erupted on the scene. And we'd been suspicious that there was microbiome differences because Africans produce a lot of methane in their breath, which is resulting from fermentation in the colon, whereas African Americans is quite rare. But then we suddenly got the tools, mainly focused on the identification of 16S ribosomal RNA. So we switched from culture techniques to genetic techniques, and the rest is history, really, because using this technique, hundreds of different types of microbes were identified in the colon, whereas they'd only been thought to be about 20 before, and, you know, with potentially thousands of different types of species as well. And so we then looked at the microbiota, and we found that it was completely different between Africans and African Americans, and that the microbiota of Africans was dominated by Prevotella, which is a type of microbe which degrades starch and liberates digestible fibers, which are then converted by the microbes to short-chain fatty acids and also releases phytochemicals. And both short-chain fatty acids and phytochemicals are strongly anti-carcinogenic in experimental studies. And so it began to sort of fit together rather well. In contrast, African Americans had low levels. They were dominated by bacteroides, low levels of butyrate producers or short-chain fatty acid producers, and but increased levels of microbes that converted bile acids to secondary bile acids, which are carcinogenic. So if you eat a high-fat, westernized diet, you produce, you stimulate your liver to produce bile acids, which pass down the gut, and if you produce a lot, they spill over into the colon, and there they metabolize to secondary bile acids, which are carcinogenic. So you can immediately see that there's a shift in the sort of balance of the microbes associated with a shift in the balance of the nutrients in the diet, from one which is helpful towards maintaining the health and preventing cancer in the colon to one that's actually doing the reverse.
So the observation that was made decades ago, and I actually remember a lecture in medical school that included photographs of bowel movements, just comparing the size and makeup of the American poop versus the African poop. And what was in Africa was much more voluminous. I've spent time in East Africa myself, and I remember the typical meal was ugali, which is the closest thing I can compare it to is grits in the American diet, and usually some greens. There was not a lot of meat in that diet. So it kind of made sense that if you think in terms of fiber as absorbing toxins, well, maybe that's what's doing it. But it sounds like the emergence of the genetic techniques really began to move the science forward again, because the culture techniques are going to be fairly limited. There's microbes that may not even be culturable that we can potentially detect through some of these genetic techniques.
Yes.
Please continue.
That's absolutely right. And there was a lot of speculation about how fiber would work, and they actually measured transit rates and were able to compare them to English schoolboys, and found that the transit time was about three times as long in Africans as it
Europeans
than in Africans. I always get transit time and rate mixed up. And the idea of that there might be environmental carcinogens derived from a whole variety of different things. The longer they stay in contact with the mucosa and the colon, the higher the risk of producing inflammation and cancer change. And what they didn't know about was this mass of highly active microbiota that we talked about earlier. A kilogram of highly active DNA living in close proximity to the mucosa likely to influence its health.
Okay. You're listening to Line One, Your Health Connection on Alaska Public Media. We'll be back in a minute to take a call. And let's give a minute break to the stations down the line.
You're listening to Line One from Alaska Public Media. You can find Line One on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back to Line One, Your Health Connection. I'm your host today, Dr. Jay Butler. My guest is Dr. Stephen O'Keefe, professor of medicine at the University of Pittsburgh. And we're discussing the interaction of the diet, the microbiome, and the risk of colon cancer. We've been talking about what the microbiome is, and we have a caller who has a specific question about the microbiome. Andy, welcome to Line One, Your Health Connection.
Well, thanks for having me. The biome is one of those things that I was thinking about in terms of space colonization. We're going to need those things when we go out into space. But more specifically, how are these things, are we at the stage where we're actually collecting these things, and are there therapies being used using the microbes that we have in our system?
Oh, great question. Dr. O'Keefe.
Yes, that's an excellent question. There's a condition called C. difficile colitis. The power of medicine is that, we allow people to survive through critical illness and live in ICUs for a long period of time. But, they're wide open to infections, and Jay would probably know more about it than I. And in order to control that situation, we need to use recurrent courses of antibiotics, which progressively knock off the microbes in your colon. And not surprisingly, diarrhea and inflammation and then colitis is the sort of end result if you have that situation where people aren't being fed any fiber in their enteral diets at all, and the microbiota are getting hammered. So the colon loses all of its defenses, and it develops this life-threatening condition called C. difficile colitis. C. difficile being one of the microbes that overgrows everything else. All the others are knocked off, but it's resistant to the general antibiotics that are given. And in that situation, we previously used to use an antibiotic called vancomycin, which did actually suppress C. difficile and did improve the condition of patients. But unfortunately, you weren't removing the bottom cause, which was a depleted microbiota. And so therefore, once the antibiotics were stopped, then the disease came back again, and a recurrent C. difficile colitis occurred again, which had an even higher mortality rate. Until we realized, well, the way to cure this is, in fact, to restore a normal microbiota. And you could do this over a period of several months by stopping all antibiotics and giving a high-fiber diet, which we tried to do, but our results demonstrated that this only had a partial effect. And because generally patients required further doses of antibiotics, and the bacteria just couldn't, you know, flourish like they normally do. Until, you know, some of my colleagues came up with the idea of infusing normal stools into people, into people with C. difficile. And the result was dramatic. And for the first time, a treatment was devised where recurrent C. difficile colitis was actually cured. And you had to get stool from a normal, healthy volunteer, which is obviously quite difficult nowadays, but we can approximate towards that. And, you know, you make a slurry of the stool and then either give it through a feeding tube through the nose into the intestine, or rectally through a tube going up the rectum. And this is probably the best example of whereby you can use the microbiota to cure acute illnesses. There are lots of other examples, but they're much more subtle.
Andy, thank you for joining us on Line 1, Your Health Connection.
I appreciate it.
So the fecal transplant is a great example of reestablishing the normal microbiome, and that was a very tasteful description of the process. I can only imagine during the studies, the process of informed consent. I could picture patients saying, "Doc, you want me to do what?" But the success of fecal transplantation compared to antibiotic treatment, particularly for recurrent Clostridium difficile diarrhea, is really quite compelling. And it can be a very vexing clinical problem when it recurs, and sometimes, unfortunately, fatal. In fact, it's been estimated by the CDC that over 20,000 Americans are killed by C. diff colitis each year. So we've talked about what the microbiome is, what it does in terms of benefits for health, and even talked about how correcting the microbiome can have therapeutic purposes. And we've talked about your findings of the bacteria in the colons of African Americans at high risk of colon cancer and Native Africans at a low risk. Let's bring the discussion to Alaska. Why do you think Alaska Native people have higher rates of colon cancer than non-Natives living in Alaska?
Now that to me was just amazing. I mean, I couldn't believe at the time that people had higher rates than African Americans, and when we got to publishing our studies, you know, we came across various reports indicating that levels might be even higher in Alaska Native people, and you know, so this was of extreme concern to us, and we think that, you know, from our previous studies, that we know a way of actually reducing colon cancer risk by modifying what you eat and therefore what the composition of your microbiota are. And my justification for saying that is that we did a very neat experiment because, you know, having established that there were differences in diet and differences in risk between Africans and, you know, Africans living in America and Africans living in Africa, it could be due to a whole lot of other factors such as food, sanitation, housing, because the condition, living conditions are quite different. So we did this rather neat experiment where we switched their diets for a two-week period. And for African Americans, we admitted them to a clinical research center in Pittsburgh and gave them African food for 2 weeks.
So it was food, not an infusion of bacteria, yep. But nothing but changing the diet.
Absolutely. We just changed the diet. So we actually kept them not quite under lock and key, but you know, we observed exactly what they ate. We fed them, we cooked the food for them, and a lot of dietary studies are faulty because you advise people to change this. They go home, they do it for a few days, and then go back to their old ways naturally. But here we actually gave the food and we observed exactly what they ate. And we measured the microbiome before, afterwards. We measured the colonic mucosa before and afterwards. And that was very important because, you know, the acceleration at the moment about studies identifying different changes or dysbiosis in microbiota in different disease states from around the world is tempered by the fact that we don't really know whether the microbiota changes are primary or secondary. And so this was important. So we need to measure not just the microbiome changes or the diet changes, the microbiome changes, but we also need to measure what happens in the mucosa. And so being gastroenterologists, we did repeated colonoscopies afterwards and did biopsies from the colon to look at the mucosa itself. And, you know, it takes longer than 2 weeks to develop colon cancer. It takes several years, in fact. And obviously we can't change somebody's diet like that for several years because people could only tolerate about 2 weeks being, you know, in an artificial environment and given a standard different diet. And instead of looking at cancer production, we look at inflammatory changes in the mucosa and changes in cell proliferation rate, which we know from other studies are indicators of cancer risk. And remarkably, these changes in diet and microbiota in African Americans were associated with a dramatic reduction in cancer biomarkers in the colonic mucosa. Then we did the same thing in Africa. So we chose a rural village where there was a lodge, and we put people up there for 2 weeks, and we gave them delicious westernized food, hamburgers and fries and barbecues.
I sense a hint of sarcasm there.
It is slightly. Well, that's the problem with you know, the westernized diet is that all the food technology has gone into making it absolutely delicious, so we can't say no. And hence obesity and everything else. You know, we're up against it. And, you know, but suffice it to say, they actually loved the westernized food to start with. And it's not that they don't like meat and fat and so on. It's just they can't afford it. And that's the problem with gradual westernization around the world. Cancer incidences are suddenly increasing. And we really wanted to identify what was good in the African diet that we could then maintain with westernization to prevent a massive increase in colon cancer in developed Africa. So the results were equally astounding, and all the microbiome and the metabolome changes that we identified at baseline were reversed in the opposite direction to what happened to African Americans. And the cancer biomarkers were increased dramatically just within 2 weeks. And the importance of this is that, you know, it actually showed that you could make a big change in your cancer risk very quickly. You don't have to wait years, or you don't have to say, well, I was born and brought up with, you know, good westernized food. It's too late now. It's not, because the sooner you change, the sooner your colon is going to change.
You mentioned that the exposure and to the microbes, as well as the development of cancer, takes time. I think I would be remiss if I didn't use that as an opportunity to point out to all of our listeners the importance of screening for colon cancer, that the opportunities for treatment and cure are much greater when the problem is detected early. And sometimes even just removal of colonic polyps can reduce your risk as well. So you're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. I'm Dr. Jay Butler. We invite you to join the conversation. I'm speaking today with Dr. Stephen O'Keefe, professor of medicine at the University of Pittsburgh, and we're talking about the diet, the microbiome, and the risk of colon cancer. Our number statewide is 888-353-5752. You can also contact us by email at line1@alaskapublic.org. And Chuck is joining us. Chuck, welcome to Line 1, Your Health Connection.
Hi. Boy, I've got so many questions. I could be your guest for the rest of the hour just asking questions. You know, what I first called about was the connection between biome, the bacterial and micro makeup, and cancer. And he sort of touched on that. But while you were talking there, it occurred to me, I'm surprised that Alaska Natives and people in Bush, Alaska, have a higher incidence, because I would think things like a lot of seafood, we eat a lot of fish, of course, salmon. I would think that would be a pretty healthy, create a pretty healthy biome and reduce the cancer risk. And the same thing with a lot of, Bush, Alaska, we eat a lot of berries, a lot of food off the land. Have there been any studies, or do we know anything about that?
Yes. So the Alaska diet is Alaska Native diet is remarkable, because you're quite right that many aspects of it are extremely good. So it's a potentially excellent diet with regard to the meat composition, because, you know, a lot of wild meats and so on are low cholesterol, and the fish contains omega-3 fatty acids, which are anti-inflammatory, rather than omega-6, which is what we take with westernized foods. And so from those two aspects, you know, the diet is excellent. But unfortunately, there's a chunk of the normal diet missing in Alaska Native people. I mean, that's our hypothesis at the moment, and that's what we're working on. And we've just got funding from the NIH to actually study and see if that really is true. But from the dietary surveys that have been performed already in rural Alaska, from, you know, mainly the sort of YK area and further north, and also a baseline study that we performed in Barrow and in Anchorage, the fiber intake is dramatically lower between Alaska Native people and rural Africans. It's about three times higher in Africans. And so the good news about that is that if, in fact, I mean, so what that would translate into would be that fiber-containing foods, such as fiber-rich foods, such as fruit, vegetables, coarse grains, you know, the intake of those foods need to be increased. If they could be increased, you'd have a near perfect diet in Alaska Native people. That is what we're trying to investigate at the moment. So we're actually performing studies where we're increasing the fiber, and we're measuring the same parameters that I talked about a minute ago, which is, you know, inflammation and cancer biomarkers in the colon mucosa, and seeing if we can't actually reverse cancer risk biomarkers. Now, you know, going back to what Jay said a minute ago, I think it's very important to put this into perspective. The known differences in incidence rates between rural Africans and Alaska Native people is enormous. It's about 20 to 40 fold. So the incidence of colon cancer is over 100 per 100,000 in most African Native groups. And particularly high up in the Barrow North Slope area, where it gets up to 180 per 100,000, which is kind of you know, unheard of. And associated with that are a lot of other GI problems as well, you know, with constipation, indicating that, as we mentioned before, transit through the bowel is much slower than it should be. And so therefore exposure to other carcinogens, either from the environment, such as smoke, or carcinogens from overcooking meat, you know, their chance of having an effect is so much higher. So, you know, if we could somehow increase the intake of fruit and vegetables or plant-based foods in the normal diet, you know, because I'm not at all against the traditional diet. We think that the traditional diet is extremely important. But with westernization, shops are becoming available. So, you know, high-calorie foods are becoming much more common and tending to replace a lot of the traditional foods in the sort of more developed areas. And what we want to do is to try and break that vicious cycle.
All right. We need to go to a break. Chuck, thank you for joining us on Line 1, Your Health Connection. We'll be right back in a minute.
Funding for Line 1, Your Health Connection, was made possible in part by the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority and listeners just like you. Thank you.
Welcome back to Line 1, Your Health Connection on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host today, Dr. Jay Butler, and we're talking with Dr. Stephen O'Keefe, professor of medicine at the University of Pittsburgh, and we're discussing the interaction between diet, the microbiome, and the risk of colon cancer. We've been talking about the differences in the rates of colon cancer among people of European descent, of Africans, of Alaska Native people, and the work that's been done that has noticed that the microbes that differ among these people group can actually be altered by changes in the diet. And we were just getting into a discussion of the healthful aspects of a more traditional Alaska Native diet. We'd love for you to join the conversation. Our number, toll-free statewide, is 888-353-5752. You can also contact us by email at line1@alaskapublic.org. And Christine is joining us. Christine, welcome to Line 1, Your Health Connection.
Hello.
Hello.
Hello. Are you here?
Hello.
I'm hearing you.
Oh, hello. Very good. Christine, yeah. Do you have a question for Dr. O'Keefe?
Yes, I do have. I live in Fairbanks, Alaska, and until about a year or 2 years ago, I tried for several years a vegetarian diet, high in fiber, high in whole grains, high in beans, et cetera, and no meat or other animal intakes except for some eggs here and there and some cheese. So the result was that diet almost literally killed me. I was constipated. I almost said like hell. It was really hard to pass stool, and whatever I did, it didn't work. So one day I had for breakfast just eggs and bacon, and I felt the difference immediately. So I really started research on that. Ever since, There were absolutely no grains on my table, no more beans, and my diet is vegetables, meats, and some fruit here and there, and I'm pretty much back to normal. Now, my hypothesis is that Native Alaska people never had access to grains before the white man arrived. And in my own experience and other people I talk to, that this sudden adding of fiber, high grains, et cetera, might cause digestive distress. And that's what I wanted to put out.
Okay. Dr. O'Keefe, interesting hypothesis that Christine offers. Any comments?
Yes, Christine, that's very interesting. You know, of course, everybody's reaction to a change in diet varies somewhat. And, you know, that's why we have to do randomized controlled trials under very, very strict conditions so that, you don't know what you're getting and, you know, you can measure it objectively because the mind has a very strong effect on the bowel, which is good. You know, but going to your point about the grain side of things, grains have been part of what we've evolved with through through you know millions of years, not just in the last you know couple of hundred years, but millions of years. And our gut has developed in Paleolithic times. And was more adapted to what we ate at those stages. And you know, contrary to opinion that in those times we mainly ate meat and we killed lots of animals and so on, it's not actually true because you know modern measurements of dental and animal dental plaque and coprophyte. Have ended with stable isotope measurements have indicated that our diet has always been rich in grains. And this is true of American Indians as well as true for every other person living on Earth. The big change in our diet occurred at the time of the agricultural and industrial revolution, which was only 300 years ago. Our argument is that 300 years is insufficient time for our gut to change to, you know, being able to tolerate a westernized diet which is deficient in fiber. And, you know, the same thing has been, you know, experimental studies in various other different primates and so on has borne out and supported this theory that our diet generally has erred away from plants and more towards meats in westernized culture, meats and fats. And so I appreciate that everyone will be slightly different, but as a population as a whole, one has to come up with recommendations. And to be honest, we don't know what the incidence of colon cancer was in Alaska Native people before the last century because, you know, people died very young. And colon cancer is one of the westernized diseases. So it only occurs in your middle age from about 40 to 65. And if you don't live to that time, you don't identify it. So so we really don't have any data on what, you know, the traditional diet what influence that had on your risk of getting colon cancer. But now, with the dramatic increase in lifespan in Alaska people, up to from 30 to over 70 to 80 years of age now, all these westernized diseases are becoming predominant. And, you know, you can link up colon cancer with heart disease, with cancer of the breast, with cancer of the prostate, with cancer of the lung, and a number of other things, and chronic arthritic conditions, most importantly, obesity and diabetes. And it's very important that to understand that a plant-based food really has a dramatic good effect upon both obesity by decreasing the amount that you eat and improving metabolic syndrome and reducing the risk of type 2 diabetes, which are other major causes of mortality within the community.
Christine, thank you for your question and for joining us today. We have several other callers. We'd like to go to Fred. Fred, welcome to Line 1, your health connection.
Yeah, good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Thank you.
Yeah, my question is, well, in the 80s, I got into reading the Fit for Life books, and my question is, I still practice it now, but it's the food combination. You know, not eating, not combining a carbohydrate and a protein in the same meal. You know, I guess proteins producing acid in the stomach and carbohydrate producing alkali and just kind of sitting there and putrefying is. And how does that affect the? I still practice it. I feel good about it, and I was just wondering what your take is on it and if. Science has changed since then.
Yeah, so that's interesting. I mean, you know, the breakdown of all foods can produce acidic molecules. So, you know, that really isn't backed up by science. And, you know, it depends where the digestion occurs, whether it occurs in the small intestine or in the large intestine. And, you know, there's no scientific support for only eating meats at one time and then carbohydrates separately. We evolved to eat whatever food was available at the time, which is usually a mixture of different things. You know, so if you've ever watched primates foraging, they would go around and they'd eat little bits of grasses and insects. And actually, there's an interesting study just come out showing that insects have a very positive effect. If you grill insects and eat them, I think they were crickets, actually, they have a dramatic effect on your microbiome and reduce biomarkers of cancer risk. So that's another thought. But I'm not proposing that.
That's not an endorsement, listeners.
but you know, the problem about diets is that everybody wants to be an expert on diet because it's something that really affects us. And we know that if we eat certain foods, it upsets us. Other ones we tolerate well. But, you know, you'll find somebody else has exact opposite effects. And, you know, so one's got to be very cautious about making dietary recommendations on evidence that is kind of shallow.
So,
all right. Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate the information and your time. Thank you. Have a great day.
Thank you for joining us, Fred. And yes, this is indeed a topic with a lot of interest, just based on the switchboard lighting up here. So we've talked about fiber, we've talked about meat and fat. Dr. O'Keefe, what is the ideal fiber requirement? What should we be eating?
Ah, you've touched on my favorite subject. So the USDA recommendations for fiber intake are 28 grams per day for women and 35 grams for men per day. And we reckon that they're about half what they should be. And I say that for a number of lines of evidence. First and foremost, you know, you should be able to get some idea of what ideal fiber content is by looking at different populations around the world and seeing who has the least incidence of colon cancer and what is their fiber intake. And so I've already said it's Africans, and if you look at their fiber intake, it's always over 50 grams per day. Birkett studies suggested that the normal fiber intake from traditional African diet was between 60 and 120 grams per day, And there are tribes in the Congo that eat 150 grams a day still today because they live in forests and they eat mainly plant-based foods. But I'm not suggesting you have to go that far. But if we go back to a whole food diet, and that includes things like legumes and beans and greens, even simple cabbage and broccoli, kale, things like that, blueberries as well, it's actually not that difficult to get up to 50 grams a day with a normal diet. I think that there's actually a threshold to the amount of fiber you need to take before it can produce benefit. And I say this because experimental studies have shown that you need to have enough fiber in your colon so that your microbiota can produce short-chain fatty acids from it. And one of those short-chain fatty acids is called butyrate. And butyrate is remarkable because it is the main energy source for the cells that line your colon. So every other organ in the body needs glucose, but the colon peculiarly actually depends upon butyrate. So you can see there's this mutualistic association between microbes and the gut. And If you have less than, say, 20 grams of fiber per day, which is the high average in the USA, you don't produce enough fiber, enough butyrate to go outside the metabolic requirements for the colon cells and to produce effects on your immune system, which has widespread beneficial effects around the body. And particularly their effects at suppressing cancer development through what's called epigenetics. I didn't want to go into too much detail.
That is a whole other program. And, of course, we're down to about 30 seconds left. And I apologize to the many callers who have contacted us. We won't be able to obviously get through all the calls today. So in the remaining 20 seconds, we eat a lot of fish and meat up here in Alaska. Are we doing the right? Should we keep doing that? And I say meat meaning game.
I believe in a balanced diet, in a whole diet, and I think we are designed as omnivores. So a little bit of meat, a little bit of fat is good for you. Excess is bad. If you overcook meat, it can cause problems. But if you can keep up your intake of fiber-rich foods or increase them, they counterbalance the effects of meat. And so you get all the benefits of a high meat diet and a high fish oil diet without any of the serious things that I talked about a minute ago, including colon cancer, and potentially can reduce your cancer risk 20 to 40 fold. That is massive. It's more than any drug can do. And it's what we should be aiming at doing in Alaska.
All right. Well, that sounds like very wise and evidence-based advice. This has been Line 1, Your Health Connection with Dr. Stephen O'Keefe. Join Prentice Pemberton next week when we'll be back on Line 1, Your Health Connection. This is Dr. Jay Butler wishing you a healthy life
and
form.
Line 1 is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line 1 and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.